day you had gone out to talk to.
Right. I had to visit my regular weekly visit. Once he had received the death sentence, then I was permitted, or have been permitted, to visit each week. And this happened when he had another execution date some years ago that I was permitted to visit each week. Prior to that, I visit every other week or every 2 weeks.
Mm-hmm. And that's set out by the prison staff? You have a
Correct.
Certain time that you're allowed?
Correct.
What takes place in those meetings?
Well, we talk a little bit about everything. And during that time, we pray. Now, today, while I was there, he had received letters from a group of students, and he read a lot of these letters to me from 7th and 8th graders. And well, he just tells me really what's going on in his life, and I try to share with him whatever's happening with me and the people that I live with or with the community, because he's very interested in the Sisters of Providence and the Sisters of Mercy. Sister Camille D'Arienzo from New York is the one that made the first contact with him. I think you remember that story.
Well, how did it all get started? If you can...
He wrote a letter to the Cherished Life Circle, which is a group that Sister Camille started up in Queens, New York. And this organization says that even should they be murdered, they do not want the one who committed the crime to be executed. So they call it the Cherished Life Circle. And there are a number of these groups in this country, and some that, I mean, it's spread to overseas also. So he wrote a letter just to the Cherished Life Circle asking, this was when he had his first execution date, asking for prayers for himself, for his victim, Andrew Marty, and also asking for someone to act as spiritual advisor for the few months that he had left. And this was before Christmas, so Sister Camille tried, he was in a Pennsylvania prison at the time, tried to get someone from that area to visit him, but everybody was busy with Christmas and so on. So since she couldn't find anyone, she and a friend went to visit him after Christmas. And she was so struck by the remorse that she saw, and she knew that it wasn't put on from David, that she truly believed, you know, everything that he told her. And she was ready to visit him a second time when he was in a Colorado prison. And the night before she was to leave, she got a call from the chaplain saying that he was being transferred the next day here to this prison. And that was in July of 99. So her second visit to him was here at this prison. And she had met one of our sisters at a meeting and told the sister about David and that she probably would be coming to Terre Haute. So Sister Diane was the one she offered her hospitality, and she stayed here in a little house next door and had breakfast with a group of our sisters, one of them being a friend of mine. And during that conversation, she said she wished there would be some sister here from the woods who could visit with David regularly. Because she would probably get here only a couple times a year. So this friend called me and asked me if I would be interested, and that was in February of 2000. So I've been visiting with him regularly since February of 2000.
And what did you think when you got that request? I mean, is it something that you had done before?
No, I had not. And I didn't say yes right then and there. I said, well, let me have some time to think about it and pray about it. And so I decided, yeah, I think I could do that. So I called her back within a day or two and said, yes, I would like to do that. So I believe my first visit was February 24th, 2000. And so I've been visiting with him regularly. I started, you know, doing it every 2 weeks at that time. And then when he got the execution date, then I was allowed to visit every week. So it's 4.5 years, really.
What did you think when you first were asked to go see him, knowing that you would be going to minister at a prison, mm-hmm, for somebody who was a convicted murderer who would be executed?
Well, I really didn't know exactly what to expect. I can say I was not afraid. I think one gets the grace to do what I felt called to do this. I felt here was a person who needed help. And one of the spiritual works of mercy is to visit the imprisoned. And I had never visited. I went to a jail once as a kid on a field trip, as it were, but I had never. So to me, it was like a real call to be of assistance to this man who was facing execution since he was on death row. So, and I've never regretted, not once, ever having said yes to that invitation.
What did you expect going into the, you know, those first sessions, and you know, what do the conversations entail since? And I know that obviously you can't speak too much or too privately, of course.
Well, I at first I visited for 2 hours, and I thought, oh my goodness, what will I say to a man that I don't even know for 2 hours? But the thing is, he is an excellent conversationalist, and I had been told this by the chaplain that he was a very good conversationalist. So things never really drag too much because he's always in there with a new idea or thinking about, you know, something. So, and then we always pray together. That's part of the time that we spend together in prayer. And I've shared a lot with him about community life and about my own family and whatever's going on in my own life. And he in turn does the same. So we're just good friends.
Does he have family who visits?
He does, yes. He, his father and brother and a sister-in-law were here in April, and they stayed here on the first floor of Owens. They were here for 2 days, and he does have a sister living. She did not come with them. And then he has cousins. All these people live in Oklahoma. That's where he was born and raised and got into trouble in Oklahoma. So his cousins came that same week, toward the end of the week, and they stayed at the Holiday Inn, but I went in to meet them because I had talked with the one cousin particularly, an aunt came too, the mother of these two girls, and so I went in to meet them. It was kind of nice to do that.
So not only are you, you know, ministering to, you know, the person who's on death row, but to also the family members.
So in a sense.
Work with their concerns too.
That's right, yes. So,
what kind of misconceptions do you think people may have about prison life and about people on death row? Mm-hmm.
Well, I think some people think of them as monsters almost, but once you get in there and begin talking with these people, you find that they are human beings with the same needs that you have or that I have or that anyone has, and they've made some bad choices in their life and made some bad or horrible mistakes. And David is the first one to say, you know, that he is responsible for what has happened. He doesn't blame it really on the fact that he grew up extremely poor, or that he had a mother who really, I think, was mentally incompetent. He does take responsibility for his actions. So,
have you talked to? I know that. What was he in prison for when he?
What
happened in Pennsylvania?
Well, he killed his cellmate. That's right. What landed him on death row. But he had been in prison for a number of other things, kidnapping and all kinds of different things. And he was in solitary confinement for a number of years. And
what do you think started him thinking more, you know, along spiritual lines?
I tell you, it's God's grace that just touched him. I believe it was right before Christmas, and it might have been 1998. And it was like the light, you know, finally struck him that he had to change his life, that it was a mess, that he had to do something constructive. And that's when he reached out to this organization that he had read about, the Cherish Life Circle. And
how does he balance that out, and how do you balance that out with the fact that his time is limited?
Well, I think he's trying to make the best use of the time that he has right now. Is that what you're asking? Today he read me letters from a group of students, 7th and 8th graders, they had written to him. And he's spending a lot of time now answering correspondence. I mean, he's getting letters from all over the world. And so he really probably is spending more time doing that, writing letters, or not long letters, but notes to these people that have written to him. And in prayer, he told me that too.
Have you or he ever been able to speak to any victims at all, or relatives of victims?
No. And I know that he has written to the Marty family a number of times, but he did get a letter, I believe, from the brother, but recently. And I think the brother was kind of like saying he should have done more for his brother. He never ever said that he forgave David for what he had done to his brother.
What does David think about that, and well, the ability to speak or not speak with?
I think he would very much, and especially early on, he really tried, I think, very hard to express to the parents of this young man. He was a young man, I think, in his 20s, his sincere sorrow for what he had done. But they never, ever responded in any way, so he just gave up after, I don't know how many attempts he made, but you know, he gave up after a while trying to get any kind of response from them.
Have you tried talking with anybody on that side at all?
No,
is that your...
I really don't feel that would be my place. I think, you know, if he made the effort and they didn't respond to him, I don't think they would respond to me either.
That's all a part of your internal process of deciding what's... What's in bounds, what's out of bounds,
what
can be talked about.
Right.
How do you get that, those feelings?
Well, I think it's good common sense, maybe, knowing that if they wouldn't respond to him, and I'm sure that his letters were sincere, that there wouldn't be any kind of response from me.
Last time I talked to you, 3 years ago, you had mentioned David Hammer, actually, when you were talking about being in the ward, you know, on the death row with Timothy McVeigh, and you had been able to talk to other prisoners as well?
No, I correspond regularly with another prisoner, and then periodically with some of the others that I've come to know through David, and they've written, but no, I would only be allowed to visit one prisoner at a time.
Is there a program that they allow for visits from?
Not if you visit one-on-one, then that's it. Now, we have sisters that go there, and they have programs with a group, both in the main prison and also at the camp. We have two sets of sisters that go there and do that. But I would not be allowed to be part of either one of those groups. It's like I visit one-on-one, and that's all I'd be allowed to do. I would not be allowed to join one of those other groups.
Have the conversations changed a bit as, you know, the scheduled date becomes closer at all? I mean, how have conversations changed, if at all? What do you discuss?
Well, I would say last week he was very frustrated. This week he was very calm. But I always find that even if he's kind of upset and frustrated at the beginning of the visit, by the end of the visit, after, you know, talking with me and thinking things through, he's usually pretty calm. Yeah. And he expects, even though his lawyers they're going to hear oral arguments about reinstating his appeals on Thursday of this week. He really says that he has no hope that anything's going to change, that the execution will go forward as planned on June 8th.
Has he resigned himself to that?
I think he has. He would prefer it not to happen, but I think in his mind, that's what he's, you know, if it doesn't happen, then hallelujah, you know. But he's, I think, not letting himself even think that there's a possibility that he would receive a stay at this point. And that's probably healthy for him to do that, I would think, rather than pin your hopes on maybe getting that stay.
How will you work around the execution if it does happen? I mean, that's after speaking with him for so long, that it will be a difficult process.
Yes, it will. It will. And I won't be alone. Sister Camille D'Arienzo, the one that made the initial contact, she is also one of his spiritual advisors, and she's coming in June 1st. And so he already has a schedule made out for us of when we're to visit during that week. So we'll have a lot of time with him. I will say that I will miss him very much. He has certainly turned his life around. He's done a lot of good in these last years of his life. And he will be missed certainly by the men on the roll, because he is a strong advocate for the rights of the prisoner. And he has set up this website, deathrowspeaks.info, and has gotten out the message about some of the things that, you know, pertain to prisoners on death row. He has, with the help of Sister Camille, they've collaborated on Christmas cards for 3 years and have raised about $20,000 for children at risk. He knows the law very well. He's called the jailhouse lawyer because he's helped many, many men with their cases who have very little knowledge of the law. So he'll be missed greatly, not only by me, but by the men on the row.
How do you think your connection to the prison and to death row will continue, if so, beyond his execution?
I don't know. I've been asked to consider something, but at this point I couldn't make a decision because I'm too wrapped up in what's happening now with David.
That's got to be, I mean, you were talking possibly a couple of months at this point?
You mean
as far as the execution date?
No, June 8th.
June 8th
is
like
the execution
two,
date.
3 weeks.
Yes, mm-hmm. Yes. It's a very short time. During that last week, he'll be allowed to have visitors, a lot of different visitors, and that's he is the one who's made out the schedule for those visits. So, but he will have people that have been approved and have visited before. There won't be any new people coming in.
So the last question I had was that I assume there will be a never-ending need as far as spiritual advisors now that Terre Haute has
exactly
been a place where the federal government
exactly
carries out executions.
Yes, and it would if I would decide to continue doing this with another inmate, it'd probably be the one person that I've been writing to through the years, and a good friend of David's, and his family. They've stayed here on occasion, well, quite a few times, anytime that we had room to take care of them. So it's like I know his family. So he's a young man, much younger than David. And so this will affect him, I know. It will affect all of the men, but especially, you know, like any place else, you have certain people that you relate to, so there are certain men there that relate well with one another.
I would assume, obviously, your opposition to capital punishment has certainly not changed.
No, it has not. No.
Do you think about the process the same way as you may have a few years ago before you were involved in the
home? Oh, well, to tell you the truth, I didn't give a whole lot of thought to capital punishment before I got involved in visiting with David. I'm sure that I never would have approved of it, but in doing all the reading and so forth that I've done, I really see it as an act of vengeance, and certainly life without the possibility of parole is a sentence that would be adequate, I think, to any crime.
Do you feel that there's been any change in public attitude from what you see over time, especially since we now have had more than a couple of executions at Terre Haute,
right,
and it doesn't attract the kind of attention that the McVeigh case had 3 years ago?
I really don't know statistics on that, about what percentage of people. It seems to me that there are more people opposed to capital punishment now than when I became involved 4.5 years ago. But I don't, I couldn't back that up with any real statistics.
Have you been more involved in the anti-death penalty movement?
Oh, yes, yes.
That?
Every first Thursday of the month, we have a demonstration down on the corner of 7th and Cherry in front of the federal building. And I almost always make that for an hour. We're down there with our banners and so forth. And occasionally people will stop to talk, or we get both pro and con statements from people as they pass in their cars.
And do you see that participation going on beyond this, strengthening perhaps, or how do you see your level of?
Oh, I would continue, yes. Oh, definitely, yes, to oppose the death penalty. Yes, our community has made a statement opposing the death penalty. So it's not just myself individually, but the community as a whole.
Are there other cases where at Terre Haute where execution dates have been set? Anything that is imminent right now?
No, his is the only one.
And this would be the third, I believe.
Fourth.
Okay.
Fourth.
Which just goes to show you, I guess. Once you get past the first couple of them, the public attention goes away.
Exactly. Right. And so that's why David really had some very definite ideas about what he wanted in connection with his execution. He wanted a public demonstration, and that will take place. Now that they've changed the time to 3 o'clock, I think this will, everything except our prayer service, we always have a prayer service here on the eve of the execution at 5 o'clock. So that will be, if the execution is June 8th as scheduled, we will have that prayer service on the 7th. Now, because the three previous executions here have been at 7 o'clock in the morning, his will be at 3 o'clock in the afternoon. So the public demonstration will be, they'll gather around 9 o'clock and march from the federal building down to the courthouse and then to St. Margaret Mary's. And then once they get there, we're going to plant a lilac bush in memory of him, because he likes lilac bushes. So I think that's going to take place. And then there will be lunch for those who wish, and then there will be a program called The Gathering. That's going to be the night before. I think that's still going to be now, because it's at 3 o'clock if it were at 7. So 5 o'clock, prayer service, 7:30, The Gathering, and there will be speakers and songs and so forth. Anyone who wants to speak can sign up, and they'll be able to say, and we're going to read. He will either make a statement or have a tape, David himself. And then there are men on the row who have written statements, and those will be read. And Bill Breeden and his wife, he's a minister, Unitarian Universalist minister, and he and his wife play the guitar and sing, and they're going to have some songs that David likes. And the Sisters of Providence are going to have some singing also.
Is it difficult to convey to people the amount of the forgiveness that David feels, or the sorrow that he feels?
I think
I'm sure there are a lot of skeptics. The people who drive past in your demonstrations.
Right. It takes a while to convince people. I think you'd almost have to talk with him or read some of his letters or read his journals. And there is a website, and his journals were on the website, to know that the man is sincere, you know, that he's not faking this and so on, that he has deep sorrow for all the evil things that he's done. And he's done a lot of them. So.
Anything else?
Okay. I was just trying to think about what else is planned. There will be the group gathering that morning, or it'll be the afternoon. I keep saying morning because of the other three times. So it'll be in the afternoon. They go to Fairbanks Park and are picked up and taken over by buses to the prison site. And there will be a program shortly before the 2 o'clock hour now, and then at 3:05. They're going to recite the prayer of St. Francis, because I believe David intends to say that prayer as part of his parting words. That's as much as I know of the planned events.
And prison staff, have they been cooperative to
yes,
you?
Yes, they have. And today, Suzanne Carter and Karen Burkhart met with the warden to talk about some of the things that we feel we'll need, since it's going to be in the afternoon and the hot sun and so forth, like to be sure to have water and ice, and they'll put up a tent probably. And for some of the others, they've had straw bales. So those two women met with the warden today.
It's an interesting dynamic to have people who, you know, are opposed to the death penalty working with people who are imposing the death penalty.
Yes, but I really don't think that this warden, maybe, you know, I mean, he can't express himself, but I don't think he is in favor of the death penalty either. That's my impression that I get.
Just carrying out the law.
Carrying out the law, right. That's his job.